But according to the Mahayana, at this point, two possibilities, or if you like, two paths, open up and disclose themselves. Having reached this point, one can either just remain there. One can allow oneself, as it were, to disappear into nirvana, to disappear from the ken of the world. One can slip into that, like the dewdrop into the shining sea. Or, on the other hand, one can turn back, and one can decide quite voluntarily to be reborn, not because there's any residue of karma left unaccounted for, but out of compassion, so that one can continue to help other living beings in the world with the knowledge, with the spiritual experience which one has gained. This is the sort of story which is told, for instance, about the great Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, whose name means the one who looks down. That is to say, the one who looks down in compassion. It is said that originally, thousands of years ago, many, many centuries ago, Avalokiteshvara was a great monk, a great yogin, and that he had practiced meditation in a cave in the Himalayas for many, many years, for the greater part of his life. And a time came, a moment came, when he found himself on the brink, on the verge, if you like, of enlightenment, or nirvana. His experience, we are told, was that he ascended ever higher and higher, one stage of super, one stage of higher consciousness to another, ever going further and further and further away from the world, through all sorts of experiences, through all sorts of archetypal realms, all sorts of paradisiacal realms, all sorts of forms, all sorts of glorious figures, experiences. And these faded away, and he came, as it were, to the shore, to the boundary of a great ocean of light. And he could see, he could hear nothing but this ocean of light. And he experienced tremendous joy and happiness that at last he was returning to his source, returning to his origins, and was going to be merged with reality itself. So with a great sigh of relief almost, we are told, he just started to let himself go, to slip into that. But just at that moment, we are told, just at that very moment he heard a sound. Heard a sound. At first he didn't know what it was, but he heard a sound coming as though from a great distance, coming as though from afar off, coming as though from far below. So this just arrested his attention, and he just listened. And he heard not just one sound, he heard many sounds. He heard, as it were, many voices, and they were all crying out, wailing, weeping, lamenting, grieving. And the sound seemed to get louder and louder. So at last, we are told, he turned his eyes, he turned his vision away from the great ocean of light, and he looked down. This is where he gets his name from, the Lord who looks down. He looked down, right down into the depths, right down to this world itself, and he saw in this world so many people, so many millions of living beings suffering in various ways, due to their ignorance, their spiritual ignorance, their lack of spiritual instruction. So then the thought came to him, or the realization came to him, that how can I leave these beings? How can I allow myself to slip into, to merge into this ocean of light, just saving myself, when there are in fact in the world below so many people, so many beings who need my help and my assistance and guidance. So he turned back. He not only looked down, but he went down, he went back into the world. And this is called the path of the Bodhisattva. The first, the path of allowing oneself to be merged in nirvana, oneself individually. This is the path of the Arahant, the one who desires his individual salvation. The second is the path, as I've said, of the Bodhisattva, the one who desires not just his own illumination, not just his own emancipation, about the liberation and the enlightenment of all living beings whatsoever, who is not satisfied until he can, as it were, gather all living beings into his arms and go with them into Buddhahood, into enlightenment, in a sort of cosmic enlightenment, as I've called it earlier on. So the second path, the second alternative, that of the Bodhisattva, is traditionally regarded as higher than the first, that of the Arahant. In fact, in a sense, the latter, the path of the Bodhisattva, includes and contains the path of the Arahant, because one must at least have the capacity to remain in Nirvana, to gain liberation for oneself, for one's renunciation of that to have any meaning or any significance at all. Otherwise, one's following of the Bodhisattva ideal may become not the following of a spiritual ideal, but only indulgence in a rationalization of one's attachment to the world. Now, Tibetan Buddhism takes this Bodhisattva ideal very, very seriously indeed. It's a living thing, a real thing for the Tibetan Buddhists. Some of you may know, some of you may have read a book by Marco Palis called Peaks and Lamas. And in the later editions of that book, there's an extra chapter which he has added. And this is called the presiding idea. The presiding idea of Tibetan Buddhism, and this is, of course, the Bodhisattva ideal, because this ideal does indeed preside over, spiritually preside over, the whole of Tibetan Buddhism. If one doesn't understand the Bodhisattva ideal, one probably hasn't understood Tibetan Buddhism one little bit. So the Tibetans, as I say, do take this Bodhisattva ideal very, very seriously indeed. They do believe that there are still living in the world people who have made this great renunciation, this great sacrifice. They do believe that there are living in the world people who have literally turned their backs upon Nirvana and who have returned to the world to help in the higher evolution of the race towards enlightenment or towards Buddhahood. For them, the Bodhisattva ideal is not just a beautiful dream. I remember reading a book by a French, I think it was Jesuit writer, certainly a Catholic writer, and he was writing about the Bodhisattva ideal. And he said, it's very beautiful, but it's a beautiful dream. There are no Bodhisattvas in the world. But he said, on the other hand, the ideal of Christianity, that is to say, the ideal of the crucified Christ, this is a historical reality. But the Bodhisattva ideal, it's just a sort of spiritual pipe dream, a sort of opium dream that the indolent Buddhist has, lying on his couch in the East and just having nothing else to do except dream up this spiritual ideal. But it isn't really like that, not at least for the Tibetan Buddhists. They regard the Bodhisattva, or Bodhisattvas, because I should use the plural, as being very much with us, as part, in a sense, of the spiritual economy of the world. And they believe very, very strongly indeed that there are some such Bodhisattvas, people who have literally turned their back upon Nirvana, living in the world and living in Tibet, and they believe that these can be identified and known, and, as it were, picked out. And amongst them, they believe very strongly, especially the Gelugpas believe, was the third abbot of Ganden and his teacher, the first abbot of Tashi Lhunpo. In other words, the first of the Dalai Lamas and the first of the Panchen Lamas.